Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Thanks for downloading the Inside Lacrosse D1 Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Flynn, joined as always by my man, Terry Foy. If you like what you hear, please tell a friend. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, leave a rating and a comment, and hit us up on Twitter at D_Fly and at Terrence Foy. If you'd like to share a thought, a comment, or a question, give us an email at dflynn@insidelacrosse.com and tfoy@insidelacrosse.com. We'd love to hear from you. On today's Vim and Vigor show, we'll be discussing the conference championships. We had our IL staff out at all the conference championships, and we'll have reports and coverage of that. We'll do some news and notes. Certainly get into the NCAA selections, seeding, and the bracket, and even make some predictions. So here we go. All right, Terry, we have so much to talk about. First of all, I would like to start by complimenting you and the other guys on the editorial staff on just crushing the content over the last week.
Lame.
No.
You can't start a podcast with a compliment. That's horrible.
I have been waiting to say this to you, and I've shared it with you and Matt and some other guys. It was amazing. Just the select spiders, May Madness they're getting a lot out of their sponsorship, and it's just been great coverage from the conference championship and championship week through Selection Sunday, and the podcast you did, that Babbo did with the D3 chair Sean Quirk, and then I saw that I think did Hallie do a podcast.
She did, just popped up on the D1.
Terry and I are doing this a day later. We're letting some of the stuff sink in.
Percolate.
Yeah.
Plus, simmer.
We delivered some extra podcast bonus features that I just mentioned. And also we wanted to have a chance to get our stuff together because there has been so much that's happened. We want to have a little bit of a chance to make some predictions and things like that.
Yeah.
As we move forward.
Well, first of all, let me commend you. Clearly, the business development portion of your title is coming to the forefront as you both complimented your boss and shouted out the quality activation sponsorship of what's going on the site right now. So kudos. Let me repay the compliment to you.
Right back in.
All right. Well, you're right, though. There is a lot to discuss. So we're going to go off a little bit script, and we can stop this. We can just move on to what we actually came here to discuss. And, I mean, to your point about how much there is to discuss, I mean, it's difficult to go all the way back to last Thursday. Crazy, crazy conference semifinals, particularly in the America East, where there were two upsets. And as opposed to the Albany-Stony Brook matchup that so many people were ready for on Saturday morning, we had Vermont and Hartford. And I think that really it underscores both the quality of this season. It underscores what this past weekend was all about. And certainly, you know, probably the biggest upset of the week in most people's minds was Marquette beating Denver in the Big East Championship. But, you know, those were not the only three. So we'll get to them as we go on. It just feels awkward to talk about something that happened 5 days ago, but also in the meantime, we went from not having an NCAA tournament field to having an NCAA tournament field.
So we'll get to all this stuff. We'll start with the conference championships. So Terry, our Kyle Devitt was on location at Brown for the Ivy League championship, and here's his report on the Ivy League championship game between Yale and Harvard.
Yale is your 2016 Ivy League champion, beating Harvard 14-9. It's their second championship in as many years. Really huge game from Ben Reeves in this contest. 4 goals, 5 assists, running the show from behind the cage, making runs for Max to score, setting his team up for the win. Harvard's Shaw played strong in goal, but ultimately it was too much Yale for Harvard to handle. And Yale came in with the big pressure early on the rides, loosened up their pressure a little bit in the second half, and were able to overtake Harvard in the fourth thanks to several goals from Kesey as well as Reeves. Just an overall all-around amazing effort from the Bulldogs.
So this felt like a very traditional Ivy League championship game that Yale wins. You know, they've really, as a program, been reinvented over the course of the presence of the Ivy League tournament. We've talked about it on this podcast a few times already. Basically, just the difference between what a postseason opportunity means versus starting your season 0-2, which they so routinely did when they had to play Princeton and Cornell in their first two games in the Ivy League season. And I think that, you know, Andy Shea has done a tremendous job of instilling a culture that believes that it can handle whatever setbacks come its way. So certainly losing to Brown in what I claim is the best game I saw this year, and then being able to rebound, bounce back from the loss of arguably your best player in Michael Quinn and your second best defenseman in Cam Mattini, who has a back issue and his return is still unknown. I can imagine you survive a one-goal semifinal game versus Penn, and you're really hoping that you're going to get another crack at Brown. Once Harvard upsets them, then it's time to refocus mentally once again. Fortunately, there's obviously the Harvard-Yale rivalry. They had played only a week prior, and it had been a one-goal game. So I would imagine that the Bulldogs' attention was pretty squarely focused on the Crimson. That being said, this is a game that Yale, you know, it felt like they took them a quarter or so to get into the game, and then really, you know, I guess catalyzed by what I thought was potentially the best goal of the weekend, Michael Kesey's coast-to-coast effort that beat the buzzer before halftime, Yale really exploded in the third quarter, pulled away, and you saw their athletic advantages come to the forefront. I think that they're so tough physically. You know, Michael Bonacci took a big hit. That was one that definitely underscores how tough they are. But there were just a handful of other guys. Brennan Mackey, a midfielder who does a lot for them between the lines. The number of times he legged out clears through the midline, took some checks right on the back, you know, did that move that middies do when they're clearing the ball where they one-handed cradle, stick it out in front of them. You know, that was really impressive. Kyle mentioned Jason Alessi's performance. Just all in all, so impressed by Yale. And particularly some of the, I don't want to say role players, but some of the guys who are not Ben Reeves stepping up and helping this team re-identify itself heading into the NCAA tournament. They turn around and get the number 4 seed, and we'll be hosting Navy in the first round of the NCAA tournament.
Terry, this was an interesting one because it was the only conference championship game that took place on Sunday.
Yep.
And based on some of the other storylines that had developed, there was certainly the case where Harvard was set up to be a bid stealer.
Well, yeah, except for the fact that they were on the bubble. So to me, a bid thief is a team that it would have had no presence in the conversation had it not been for stealing the AQ. And so I think Army, you know, was an example of that the week prior had they beaten Loyola in the Patriot League Championship. Harvard, yes, they would have stolen a bid insofar as Yale and Brown definitely would have gotten in. But I thought that even with a loss to Yale, Harvard deserved to be in the conversation because they had that top five win over Brown, because they had two additional quality wins, and because their metrics were pretty good. And I think that ultimately, I projected that Harvard was going to be in.
And at 8-8.
Yeah, and I do think that they deserve to be in over Navy.
At 8-8.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I know that, like, a lot of times people point to, I have been an advocate for the idea that your record, your win percentage, is a part of the criteria. But because it's so obvious, it almost feels like routinely people jump past that. Harvard has gotten into the NCAA tournament by an at-large bid with a 500 record. They did it in 2006 at the expense of the Loyola Greyhounds. It wouldn't have obviously been unprecedented. That being said, not all 8-8s, not all 500 records are made the same. And I think that, you know, I am a guy, not necessarily personally, because again, one thing I think people don't understand about the way that I approach trying to project these brackets is not trying to parse out how I interpret the criteria and implement that. It's not what I think the bracket should be if I were given the task of implementing the agreed upon NCAA selection criteria. What I'm trying to do is take what I have seen the committees do in the past by virtue of having done this job since 2008 and say, this is how I think they're going to operate. Like I said, all year, this committee was very unfamiliar to me because there were so many new faces. Richie Mead was not a member of the committee last year. Joe Amplo was not a member of the committee last year. Some of the really prominent voices that had been on the committee for the full term have rotated off. And so there was going to be a lot new in the decision-making processes. I thought that Harvard, because of their quality wins and because of the way the quality wins had been emphasized over the last couple of years, were going to get in over Navy, and obviously that didn't end up being the case.
And he's referencing their top five win over Brown, their other quality wins where they beat Duke early in the season and Villanova to start the season.
Yep.
So, but they came a while ago, but that's allegedly not a criteria that is looked at by the committee of when the wins occur.
Correct? Well, when you say allegedly, you mean that they don't actually take it into account. But it certainly is not a part of the criteria with respect to what it actually says paper.
We'll discuss exactly how the selections came down, Terry's conversations with some of the coaches and committee members later on in the podcast. So I want to save some of that. But You'll see this conversation happen over the course of the next couple of games that we talk about, that we are of the opinion that the committee did not necessarily stick to what they say is their criteria for selections. One other interesting point of this Ivy League championship is another host of a conference tournament got beat, and this is a theme that we'll see often throughout the next few games that we look at.
Yep.
All right. Our Jason Myers was over at the Big East Championship in Denver, and here's his report on Marquette's upset win.
Thriller of a game, Marquette won by a score of 10-9. DU actually got out to a pretty big first half lead. They were up around 7-2, and really dominating faceoffs and ground balls. Second half, totally different. Marquette comes out as dominating ground balls. Absolute stellar wing play, and they go on a 6-0 run to take the lead for the first time since the first quarter against Denver. Tanner Thompson had a hat trick the third quarter. Denver made a few changes, shift Zach Miller down to attack. Zach had a couple of goals in the fourth quarter, but Andy DeMache, wearing the number 6 during this weekend to honor injured teammate Kyle Whitlow, buried the game winner, and then absolute wild sequence at the end. Marquette had the ball. Christian Berger forced a turnover, went down, and then Marquette got the ball back and ran the clock out. Absolute corker here in Denver.
This is one of those games where there's no other way to slice it. You just have to give a tremendous amount of credit to Marquette. And I think it's primarily because they just kept coming. You know, so it was a one-goal win. At periods of time over the course of the game, and I was able to watch this game pretty closely, it never really felt like Denver was in a position to actually grab the game by the throat and totally pull away. Even when they carried a 7-3 lead into halftime, it was interesting. So I was watching this game. I was watching the portions of the first half with my wife, and I was saying that, like, in this game as well as in the Rutgers-Maryland game, you know, when the top seed is a heavy favorite, there are essentially three moments in the game that the underdog needs to control or navigate so as to be in a position to take the upset. The first is right at the beginning of the game. And it's, you need to come composed to the degree that you can adhere to your game plan, make it competitive, build belief within your own team that you're going to be able to win. The second is at some point in the third, mid to late third quarter into the early fourth quarter, when good teams, heavy favorites, pull away from teams that have been competitive with them to that point because they have worn them down physically or mentally. And oftentimes, the ability to stay close in those situations, they come down to sometimes quirky plays, sometimes taking advantage of your opponent's mistakes if you're the underdog. And then the last is obviously being able to make clutch plays, crunch time plays, winning plays, the plays that separate loss from victory in a one-goal game, which is so frequently what you see happen in these types of upsets. Marquette really sunk their teeth into that middle moment. By scoring 6 goals in the third quarter, they were able to essentially press the reset button on the entire game, and they carried a 2-goal advantage into the final frame, which they were able to hold off for a 1-goal win. And there were a couple of guys that really stood out. Obviously, Tanner Thompson with 4 goals and an assist was really impressive. I thought that Andy DeMache was maybe the biggest factor, maybe the biggest the playmaker that made the plays at the right moments that helped them to this victory. But ultimately, it just felt like they went toe-to-toe with Denver, and they didn't blink.
Terry, I love the story that head coach Joe Amplo told you about coming out of the locker room a few years ago, their first trip to Denver with this team. And he was crediting a senior class and those guys for believing and explaining to them at the time how someday, if they listen to what he says, believe in what they're doing, that they'll be able to beat Denver, and how it's come finally, you know, able to beat them and win the Big East championship, and how rewarding and gratifying that was, and overwhelming, you know, as a coach to see these young guys grow and develop under his leadership in a short amount of time. And it's a great story.
It's a really interesting program insofar as when Marquette made the decision to add men's lacrosse, they did so for basically two reasons, as I can understand it. They wanted to increase their footprint within the Midwest, and they knew that lacrosse was an opportunity to do that. And it felt like they wanted to be, I don't know what the right term is, I sometimes say better neighbors, basically better conference members. So it was becoming clear that the Big East was putting more of an emphasis on men's lacrosse, particularly with Syracuse joining the Big East and essentially helping the program or the conference go from not sponsoring it to sponsoring it. So those two factors suggest to me that there is going to be a heavy commitment. Then there was tremendous turmoil, both within the athletic department and within the university administration in terms of personnel. So I believe that the number is there have been, in Joe Amplo's tenure as men's lacrosse coach, two presidents and either, this might sound crazy, four athletic directors, something wild like that. And in all of it has meant that they still, in their practice facility, keep their equipment in a storage container. It's not a program that has been dealt incredible resources and then just been sent out to say, go win games. Joe's approach to building this team, building this culture, and building this roster was different from some because of his experience and network at Hofstra. He brought a number of players with him. When you put Marquette side by side with the likes of High Point, Michigan, Furman, Richmond, they're the team that I would argue has been most reliant on transfers. There are some coaches of those upstart programs who would say that that's not the right way to go in terms of building your culture. There are others that would say you're bringing in guys who are looking for new opportunities, and particularly when you already have a pre-existing relationship with them, which Joe did with a few of the Hofstra championships, you know, some of the danger is undercut. But ultimately what it adds up to is this is a program that got to be an NCAA tournament team very quickly. And I think that it's distorted the perception of how other upstart programs should act. I think that it has meant that instead of giving an overwhelming amount of credit to Marquette, there have been some who have kind of degraded the performance of the other RSR programs who haven't achieved this yet. And I just don't think that's the right perspective. I think that what Marquette has done has been remarkable and very special. And I think it's a credit to the coaching staff.
Terry, you also talked to Bill Tierney after this game. And he gave a lot of credit to Marquette. But he also thinks that this can help his team. And it's time to refocus and get ready for the second season.
Yeah, I mean, I think that ultimately, we talked about it last week, losing late in the year is not the worst thing that can happen to a program, particularly those that have national championship aspirations. For Marquette to have lost to Villanova probably would have meant the end of their season. So clearly peaking at the right time being conference championship weekend, is integral. But that's because their aspirations are to make it to the NCAA tournament. Now that they're in, well, I think they're hoping that they peak next week so that they can make it to the Final Four.
Yeah, and as we said, we'll get into the selections and the seeding, but it didn't seem to hurt Denver at all. Terry, moving on to the Big East Championship, Dan Abern was there for Inside Lacrosse at Homewood Field, and here's Dan's report.
Was he at the Big East Championship or the Big Ten Championship?
The Big Ten Championship.
Did you say Big Ten or say Big East?
I meant to say Big Ten. Dan Abern was at the Big Ten Championship at Homewood Field, and here's his report.
Dan Abern here for Inside Lacrosse at Homewood Field, where I just saw Maryland defeat Rutgers 14-8 and claim the Big Ten Championship. For Maryland in this tournament, it's mostly about their offense, posting 30 goals in the span of 3 days for a team that usually posts anywhere from 10 to 12 goals on average. They rode the play of Matt Rambo, who finished with 3 goals and 3 assists. It was also another 4-goal night for Connor Kelly. Rambo finished with the most points out of any player in the tournament and was named the tournament MVP. It was also a huge night in cage for Maryland goalkeeper Kyle Bernlohr, finishing with 16 saves. With the win, Maryland became one of 3 conference number 1 seeds to win their conference tournament. And now with Marquette beating Denver, their shot at a number 1 seed is looking very good.
Was Maryland's win over Rutgers, and particularly the degree to which they were able to separate early, a surprise to you?
No, not at all. The way Maryland is playing right now, they are the best team in the country. And I've said this before, they're solid all over the field. They are a confident team. They play with intensity and discipline, and they're going to be tough to beat in the NCAA championship.
What's interesting to me is you mentioned, obviously, they're tough all over the field, and to me, the way in which that starts is just at the faceoff X. When we talked about it, were they going to throw everything they had at the faceoff X, given the fact that they had guys in Bonaparte and Henningsen who were beaten up? And both those guys took draws. That being said, the Terps went 11 for 24 in this game. So it wasn't as if they totally dominated possession, which was one of the things that was projected as being an issue for Rutgers. That being said, the Terps outground ball Rutgers 28-23. So when you have a two faceoff disadvantage, that means that Maryland came up with five more ground balls in open field situations than Rutgers did. And to me, you know, that's significant. You know, those five extra possessions per or over the course of the game, you know, in a that can lead to the type of lopsided score you see. I was also really impressed. A lot of people talked about how Rutgers needed to get Maryland to play at their tempo in order to have a shot to beat them. Maryland took 47 shots. That's insane. Maryland never takes 47 shots. And if they do, and they actually did talk about this in the broadcast, a lot of times those shots aren't meant to hit the cage. All of that being said, they scored 14 goals, 9 of which came in the first half. The game was never in doubt. Just really, really impressed by Maryland. They deserve the number one seed. Very interested to see how do they have to shake things up a little bit for the sake of shaking things up. I don't think that they do in week one when they're going to be playing game winner. But if they get Albany or Syracuse in quarterfinals, an Albany team that they've already played once and a Syracuse team that is very good, do they have to do something to reinvent themselves and be ready in order to make sure that they don't get bit?
Well, we will see. Terry, moving on to the America East Championship. Matt Kinnear, our editor-in-chief, was up in Albany for that one, and here's his take on that.
The Hartford Hawks are going back to the NCAA tournament for the first time since 2011. The Hawks shocked Albany on Thursday night, then kept that momentum going into Saturday for a 17-16 win against Vermont. Dylan Protesto was as good as advertised, building on a 70%-plus regular season from the Faceoff X by earning MVP honors for the tournament. Saturday, he went 19 of 30 and was especially key in a 6-goal Hartford run in the second quarter. But Hartford also showed that it's not just a team with one star at the Faceoff X. Dylan Jinks continued his great freshman campaign with 3 goals and an assist Saturday. Alec Brown was phenomenal with 3 goals. And Justin Huggins, who was the star and hero against Albany a few days ago, had a hat trick. Jaden Henderson is the player, though, who brings it all together. He's the glue guy, a phenomenal assist man, a person who does a lot of little things all over the field, assisted on 5 goals. It's a really young Hartford team, one that's going to be a contender in the America East for a few years to come. Vermont, on the other hand, came into this tournament feeling disrespected by the league, disrespected by the media. They beat Stony Brook when everyone thought it was going to be a Stony Brook-Albany final. Cam Milligan played great again, and for the second straight game had an unreal goal. And Vermont, for the early part of this game, controlled the game with a fast pace, lightning speed, always a threat to score. But Hartford ultimately had the X factor. Hartford will learn its tournament opponent on Sunday, but for now, they're celebrating their second trip to the dance.
So a surprising championship game final. Probably not what the ESPN team was hoping for that 10 a.m. Saturday's time slot when they were hoping for Stony Brook and Albany in an up-and-down kind of game. To see Hartford and Vermont there was a surprise to many, including this podcaster right here.
That being said, well, is it? Because you have been on Albany over the course of the last 2 or 3 weeks.
We will get to that, Terry.
What you just said is potentially true. I don't know how much cachet Albany and Stony Brook bring to the casual fan in contrast to the lacrosse fan. I don't know who's watching lacrosse at 10 a.m. on a Saturday morning.
Two top 20 teams. I was
less interested in watching Vermont Hartford.
I was ready to watch that one.
Well, then you missed out because this game was awesome. I mean, I said that it was the second best game I've seen all year. I thought it was great, and it was the scoring, it was the up-and-down nature, it was the number of guys making plays, it was the very clear fact that the coaching staffs were not afraid. I was so impressed. I thought that it was interesting because I missed the first bit of the game because I was attending the American Visionary Art Museum's Kinetic Sculpture Race, which is a staple on the Baltimore social calendar. It's basically when a bunch of crazy people put together crazy design floats and ride their bikes 15 miles including through the Baltimore Harbor and man-made sand and mud pits, but that's neither here nor there. So I arrived home in time to see that Vermont had built an early lead. I believe it was 6-2. Hartford went on an incredible run, and I want to say they scored 8 of the game's next 9 goals. And watching that, I thought to myself, I don't understand how Vermont beat them 13-4, I believe, in the regular season meeting, much less built a 6-2 lead on this day because Hartford looks so dominant. And then the Catamounts started to inch their way back, and you saw the brilliance of Ian McKay and Cam Milligan and, you know, the depth that they have in the Barlow kid. And And so while Jaden Henderson continues to impress me so much, and obviously Dylan Protesto, the faceoff specialist for Hartford, was a special player for them, and type of kid who can change the fortunes of a program pretty single-handedly. Ultimately, both these teams were pretty evenly matched, and that was the way that it shook out, as they went on to play a game that featured 33 goals and was decided by one.
Terry, Chris Rosenthal was down in Richmond for the SoCon Championship, and here's his report.
Chris Rosenthal here in Richmond, Virginia, side of the 2016 Southern Conference Championship. Air Force is your champion, defeating Richmond 9-8 in overtime. The game was very similar to Air Force's game on Friday against Bellarmine. They were able to score with limited possession time early on, whereas their opponent required extended possessions, but the same results as Air Force. We were tied 4-4 heading into the break. Neither team really able to build any sort of substantial lead. Coming out of the break, J.P. Forster scored first for Richmond, but Air Force responded by scoring four unanswered goals. Richmond then came back with three goals of their own, tying us at 8 at the end of regulation. And heading into overtime, the Falcons won the faceoff to start things off. Richmond never got the ball back. Andrew Tien buried the game winner. Air Force Falcons, the 2016 Southern Conference champs, grabbing the automatic qualifier for the NCAA tournament.
So in their maiden season in the SoCon, the Falcons come away with an overtime victory over the hosts. Your theme is catching up.
Yeah, only two teams that hosted these conference championships won.
This was a neutral site conference championship, so it wasn't as if the number one seed lost, which obviously was the case in most of the other ones. But this was another really well-played game. You know, J.P. Forster and Jean-Luc Chetner carried the bulk of the offensive load for Richmond. I thought the thing that impressed me the most was the fact that Benny Pugh, who I believe had only played 5 minutes, played a little bit of the end of the game of the conference semifinal, and only played that over the course of Richmond's preceding 6 games, I think it was. He had last played against North Carolina in late March. Came in, he only made 5 stops in the second half and let in 5 goals. But those stops were enormous, and they kept Richmond alive. They kept them within striking distance. And I think ultimately when it comes down to it, the fact that when it comes down to it, Air Force was the better team. Richmond was able to keep it close because they had a good game plan for Chris Walsh. He was not allowed to explode. Doug Gushaw made enough nice saves. And ultimately the reason that Air Force was able to win is because their just slight betterness came to the fore late in the game.
Terry, this game was so even. I'm looking at the box score. Faceoffs, 22-22. Turnovers, 13-12. Ground balls, 26-23. Saves, 11-10. Shots, 25-33. No surprise this one went to overtime and was so close.
And I think that ultimately, you know, it's an interesting kind of dynamic now that we've seen. Air Force is such a good fit in the SoCon by virtue of the fact that you saw Richmond play Air Force in the play-in game 2 years ago. When Air Force won the ECAC in its final season. And then obviously Richmond makes it back to the SoCon Championship in 2015. They're upset by High Point, who makes their NCAA tournament debut and falls to Towson in a very hotly contested playing game. And then here we are, Air Force and Richmond, back in the 2016 SoCon Championship. The Falcons managed to avoid the playing game and head to Notre Dame in the first round of the NCAA tournament. I mean, it just feels like, you know, this is a really nice place for Eric Saramet's squad. And coming off of a season in which they didn't have that apple, that brass ring to chase, and they knew that they had such a high tightrope to walk in order to be in tournament at large contention, I think it really did undercut their season in a meaningful way. And so, you know, it's a bummer when you have a team that could win this type of conference isn't able to play for that. I think that I took some small consolation in, you know, for as much as it was a bummer to see Richmond lose on their home field, it was good to see Air Force get back in the NCAA tournament by virtue of what I think is a nice fit for them in their program.
Moving on to the Colonial Championship, Terry. Our Jeff Shannon was there as Towson and Sean Allen's Tigers suffocate a 4-2 win over Fairfield. Here's his report.
Hey, everybody, this is Jeff Shannon with Inside Lacrosse Magazine, here covering the CAA Championship. Towson takes it with a 4-2 victory over Fairfield. This was a tight defensive game. Towson's Mike Lowe won the tournament's most outstanding player award for his defensive prowess, going up against CAA co-player of the year, Colin Burke. He held Burke, Fairfield's attackman, to 0 goals on 10 shots. Towson finally got their offense going in this contest in the third quarter when Spencer Parks hit a pass to Tyler Conan for their first goal of the game. They followed up with 2 goals, one from Joe Sider, another one from Spencer Parks, to make it 3-2 at the end of the third. Then Parks added a fourth goal in the fourth quarter for the final score of 4-2. With the win, Towson earns a bid to the NCAA tournament. This is their second bid in as many years. This is also their second CAA tournament victory in as many years.
I thought Jeff summarized it nicely on Twitter when he said, "I covered a lot of games this season, and this was one of them."
Yeah, this one was not exactly made for TV either. Just a slugfest, 4-2. You know, this was locally in Baltimore. This was tape delayed, and it was preempted by a North Carolina Louisville basketball game on Comcast Sportsnet. And
wait, what?
Yeah, on Comcast Sportsnet is where this aired, and it was the baseball game went late.
Oh, when you said basketball. I thought it was like they played a basketball game from earlier in this.
I thought I said baseball. Anyway, it went extra innings, and then they had the Caps pregame show. So they had to, if there was ever a game that they were going to shorten down to about an hour, this was the one. I think they more or less showed the first quarter and the fourth quarter. And you didn't miss much. You didn't miss much of this in the second and third in terms of scoring. I'm sure there was a lot of strategic moves and lots of guys running up and down the field.
Well, if this were a soccer game, it would have been a very exciting one.
Or a baseball game. Actually, it was not as exciting as the Carolina-Louisville baseball game. Which
you're
I was
not allowed to
angry
say
that was
soccer.
On and then said, you know what, this is... Because it was also tape delayed, so I knew the score before the game came on. So I wasn't really upset.
We'll talk about Towson when we get to the portion where we talk about the bracket.
Moving on. The NEC Championship, Joe Santoliquido was there to see Hobart in a big upset. And here's his report.
Hobart happened to be the surprise team of the NEC tournament over the weekend, winning its first NEC championship by defeating number one seed St. Joe's 11-7 at St. Joe's Sweeney Field on Saturday. The interesting part of the weekend is the fact that Hobart beat two teams, Bryan in the semifinals and St. Joe's in the championship game, two teams that defeated Hobart by a combined 28-7 during the regular season. This will be the first time Hobart will be advancing to the NCAA tournament since 2004, when Hobart head coach Greg Raymond was a junior at Johns Hopkins.
Really tremendous turnaround out of Hobart. I mean, obviously, a lot has been made out of the cumulative loss, the cumulative scores of their losses to Bryan and St. Joe's in the regular season, and I was only able to catch the end of this one, which really meant that I was only able to catch the celebration. But there's something that you can glean from that, which is how much pride and almost relief there was, as well as the sense of, you know, joy that comes out of winning a game like this. I think it was interesting to watch St. Joe's reaction as well. This is a team that was lost in the conference championship game a few times, including last year, and I think that the way that they just kind of sunk after the final whistle suggested to me that there was a lot of thoughts going through their head that was to the effect of, not again, you know, when are we going to get past this? When are we going to get over this hump? And to be fair, I would imagine that that's something that Hobart experienced as well. They were in the conference championship game 2 years ago and lost to Bryant. And I think that under Greg Raymond, they've been continuing to grind against the millstone. And to see a program who a week ago would have been so unlikely to achieve this goal, that we projected them via a mathematical formula to have a 5% chance of winning the NEC, to be able to make that 1 in 20 times a reality is so awesome. I mean, there's really no other way to describe it. And again, you know, we can talk a little bit about this matchup when we talk about their game against Towson, but got to tip your cap to, you know, the statesmen and their staff for continuing to believe, because that is a steep hill to climb coming off of a 15-2 loss against Bryant in the regular season. Turn around, you beat the Bulldogs in the semifinals. I mean, I think that it's probably one of those things where once you do that, beating St. Joe's in the championship game is kind of a downhill sled. It's like, well, we already managed to climb that 13-goal deficit hole that we were in against the team that has won the conference the last 4 years. Why can't we beat St. Joe's? And they ended up being completely accurate.
So Hobart wins their first championship.
Their first NEC championship.
And makes it to the NCAA tournament the first time since 2004. Joe Santoliquido wrote a great article about the Hobart Statesman and Greg Greenman and his team that is on InsideLacrosse.com today, so go check that out.
And I want to make a comment about that article, because I want to commend Greg for how open he was about how many changes he needed to make. He talked about how there were some disciplinary issues, how there were some academic issues. And he said he kicked between 12 and 14 players off the team in the first season because they were used to breaking rules and they weren't willing to make the necessary compromises and sacrifices in order to, I would imagine he would put it this way, earn the right to play lacrosse at Hobart. There are a lot of different styles and a lot of different ways that coaches can lead programs. Certainly that approach is not an unfamiliar one. That being said, I think it's something that many people have started to believe doesn't have a place in the modern world, that you have to be more permissive, or at the very least more willing to meet your players and team halfway or some portion of the way. And I'm not at Hobart every day. I don't know what it's like. That being said, I have to imagine that there's some firmness to the way in which they instill discipline. And I think that, you know, it's easy to justify that. It's easy to say that it worked when you won. But it's much more difficult to, maybe it's much more real to say the reason that we were able to win is because of our commitment to the discipline and the commitment to the approach. It's an ipso facto argument or an ad hoc prop d'air post hoc, something to that effect. I don't know.
Where are you going with that?
But I do think that it's to be commended, and it is a worthwhile story. I was just particularly gratified by the honesty that Greg brought to that story in saying that it wasn't smooth sailing from the get-go.
Yeah. Terry, moving on, our last conference championship was from the MAC, where Quinnipiac beat the Marist Red Foxes 13-9. Matt Kinnear has the coverage.
Quinnipiac has had a special season, and it's going to continue into the NCAA tournament after winning the MAC's automatic qualifier on Saturday afternoon. Quinnipiac, the number one seed, beat the number two seed Marist 13-9. There was also an aspect of revenge for the Bobcats, who last year went into an early hole in the MAC championship game against Marist and couldn't get out of it. But not this year, as Quinnipiac burst out of the gates to a 4-0 lead. Will Vitelli, who was perfect in the regular season game against Marist earlier in the year, won 9 of 10 draws in the opening quarter and went 20 of 25 overall. This game featured some of the chippiness of last year's, but it was a different result with Quinnipiac winning it. Jack Brust was the tournament MVP, and for good reason. He silenced a Marist team that refused to go away in this game. For instance, at 12-8, with Marist pushing with a 2-goal surge, he made a huge save, then fed downfield to Drew D'Antonio for the dagger. D'Antonio led all scorers with 4 goals, and he was joined by Ryan Keenan, 2 goals, 2 assists, Brian Feldman, 2 goals, 1 assist, Foster Cuomo, 2 goals, and Connor Meth, a goal and an assist, as key contributors for the Bobcats. It was Quinnipiac's first MAC title since joining the league in 2014.
When these two teams met in the regular season, Quinnipiac faceoff specialist Will Vitelli was perfect. I believe he was 21 for 21 on the day, and it wasn't as dominant. He was 20 of 26 against the Red Foxes. He won all three fourth-quarter faceoffs and started 9 of 10 and started 14 of 16. So, obviously, Quinnipiac was able to dominate possession. Marist was able to make a little bit of headway in the third quarter. All of that being said, Quinnipiac's an interesting squad, both in terms of how they project this year as well as how they project in the MAC going forward. You know, they've brought in some really nice talent, and I think that they're going in the right direction. Foster Cuomo is an attackman who I think is one of the best freshmen in the country. And what's surprising about it is that that doesn't take anybody by surprise. People knew that he was going to be this good when he was a senior in high school. And, you know, maybe it's a function of the fact that this is, you know, early recruiting coming home to roost. A player like this is able to go to Quinnipiac, even though people knew he was good when he was a junior and senior in high school, because perceived better programs didn't have space for him. Or maybe it's just that he wanted to go to Quinnipiac. And if that's the case, it suggests the other side of the possibility, which is Quinnipiac has really separated itself in a meaningful way as a men's ice hockey power. And a program that can do that, an athletic department that can do that, can be very good in men's lacrosse. And it'll be fascinating to see what the future holds for the Bobcats.
Okay, moving on. Before we get into NCAA selection seeding bracket, there's some news and notes we want to go over. There's some more coaching openings.
There are.
The America East is becoming vacant.
The America East conference meetings in December are going to be a meet and greet.
Yeah, that's great.
So Ryan Curtis, Vermont head coach, takes the Catamounts to, I believe, their first ever conference championship game appearance. And then 2 days later, the announcement, the news comes down that he is leaving to teach and coach at the Westminster School, a Founders League school in Connecticut. I'd heard rumblings of this, so I wasn't surprised. On the other hand, it's always surprising when you see a guy who has been at a program for 10 years leave after that program's most successful season. That being said, and this is speculation, kind of a projection, coaching in some of these private schools, particularly in New England, it's great. They're great jobs. And when you compare that with some of the obstacles and some of the downsides of being a D1 head coach, it's understandable why a guy would make that choice. We've seen assistants do it with increasing frequency over the last 5 years. And I wouldn't be surprised if this becomes a little bit more common among D1 head coaches. And I also do think that we've seen a number of guys who were prominent D1 head coaches go on to coach high school lacrosse after they were done. So essentially late in their careers, and Tony Seaman at St. Andrews is probably the highest profile example of that. Now, coaching high school lacrosse is a good gig, no question about it. The other opening, Scott Nelson is no longer at Binghamton. He has had stops as a head coach at Brown, Marist, and Binghamton. And, this was one that it did surprise me. I hadn't heard anything about this. Obviously, the Bearcats didn't have the season that they wanted to, but one of Scott's sons, Tucker, just graduated after the 2015 season as one of the most decorated players in program history. He has another son who's a freshman on the roster. That element surprised me a little bit, given the fact, the cumulative impact that you're talking about. Now 3 of 7 America East head coaching positions are open, and we've heard rumblings about a fourth that may or may not come open. It's just a fascinating state of affairs, and I don't necessarily know if there's a cause. It feels more coincidental, but between UMBC, Binghamton, and Vermont all having new leadership next year, it's an interesting time to be in the conference.
Yeah, those three America East schools joined Jacksonville and Princeton openings that we already knew about to make 5 D1 jobs open, and the tournament hasn't even started yet.
Yeah. I do think that there's going to be some delay. I don't think any of these jobs are going to be filled in the next 3 weeks. It has been the case that some jobs get filled before the quarterfinal weekend, but because so many candidates are going to come online over the next 2 weeks, both head and assistant coaches, I really don't expect to see any movement in the next 2 weeks in terms of any of these 5 jobs being filled.
And there really isn't a rush other than you losing your candidate. I mean, the way recruiting is taking place, you know who your incoming freshmen are going to be. You want to make sure that those guys are still going to come if there's a coaching change. But the recruiting trail, the recruiting road, doesn't really start until early June.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and I don't think that – well, there are two elements to that. The first is athletic directors, the people that are hiring the men's lacrosse coach, probably don't care that much about whether or not the kids honor their commitment. In their mind, as long as we get some kids in, we want to be as good as we can be, but if we lose a couple kids in this process, as long as we get the right guy, it's not the end of the world. If you're
I'm saying the coach's job,
I know.
Once he's hired, that's just...
No, I know. I totally agree with that. But my point is that, if there's a kid who's already made his decision to leave between now and when the coach gets hired, and he finds a new home.
You don't want that kid anyway.
He's, well, okay, maybe. But also, he's like, the new coach isn't going to have any, it doesn't matter. Like, he's not going to be able to do anything because the kid's already found a new home. The other point that you made about the recruiting trail starting in mid-June, I agree with that. But I also think that it doesn't even matter that much then, because all these guys, you're almost certainly going to hire a current active coach. He's going to be on the trail for his current job. So he's going to be familiar.
Switch his shirts mid-event.
I mean, crazier things have happened.
Yeah. No. We've actually seen something like that over the summer during our events. And it is funny to see. But good point. Terry, also, we have some announcements about our lacrosse industry summit that we're doing in Philadelphia. That's Friday, May 27th. We've added someone to one of our keynote panels we're very excited about. One of the panels is Lessons for Lacrosse from Peer Sports. We already had Howard Handlers, the Chief Marketing Officer of Major League Soccer, and Jeff Price, who's the Chief Commercial Officer of the PGA. And we're happy to announce that Demora Smith, Executive Vice President of the NFL Players Association, will be joining that panel, bringing a football perspective to the lessons that lacrosse can draw from other sports.
Are we allowed to announce that?
Well, I just did.
Good on you. Demora Smith is a guy who has a close relationship with lacrosse. His son is a 2017 midfielder going to play at Hartford.
That is correct.
In NCAA tournament team. And I'm really excited. I think it's going to be great. I think that anybody with an affiliation with the NFL has a perspective of being associated with the premier professional sports brand, probably the premier sports brand in the world. I think anybody that has that perspective, as well as an interest in lacrosse, is going to be able to bring something very nuanced. And I also am interested in the differentiation between representatives from Major League Soccer and the PGA, insofar as just the structure of the players and the fans are different. There's no college golf that drives spectators in a meaningful way. So the PGA doesn't have to really concern itself with college golf. Major League Soccer obviously has so much in terms of competition abroad, that its perception or its perspective, you know, with respect to being the pinnacle of its own sport is different from the NFL. So, you know, and then obviously there's a huge component of the fact that Demora Smith does not work for the NFL. He works for the NFL Players Association. So his perspective as being very much an advocate for players is going to be interestingly juxtaposed against the other two guys as well. So I think it's going to make for a great panel, and I'm really, really glad that we were able to make it happen.
Yeah, and as the executive director of the NFLPA, he's elected by the Players Association, which is a cool way to determine. It's not something he's just appointed or sort of promoted to.
Or hired.
Yeah, so he's elected to, and he was elected most recently unanimously by the players in 2009. So he'll add quite a different perspective to it, and we're very excited about it. Terry, let me tell you a little bit more about the Lacrosse Industry Summit.
Happy to hear it.
It's a gathering of the lacrosse industry's most influential people to share insights and spark discussions that will help shape the future of the sport. If you work inside the sport of lacrosse or in an industry or in the sports industry, you need to be there. The summit will take place on Friday, May 27th at the Lowe's Hotel in downtown Philadelphia. All-day conference will consist of a mix of panels and forums that allow for conversation, discussion, and sharing of ideas on the business of lacrosse. If you're working in lacrosse or your business intertwines with the sport, then you need to be there. For tickets and more information on the summit, go to insidelacrosse.com/summit.
A peek behind the curtain. Most people probably don't realize that you wrote that live read while I was on one of my extended rants last week.
That's true. That's how it goes. I'm a pro, Terry.
You're a media pro.
I'm a pro. Getting back to some more important things, Terry.
There's nothing more important than the Lacrosse Industry Summit, Dan.
Well, let's talk about our broadcast, webcast, observation of the week. And I have two. One.
Good, because I don't have any. I watched too much lacrosse. I was too inundated by it that I couldn't parse out a single thing that resonated with me.
Here's the first. How amazing, how fun is it to watch the team celebrate Hartfords, the Marquettes, the Hobarts of the world, when they win that conference championship, the automatic qualifier, most of the time in upset fashion, it is so glorious to watch them celebrate, run out, grab their goalie, pig pile in the middle of the field, throw their equipment around. It is it's a great celebration of all of the reasons why we love sport, and those are always fun to see.
I mean, so my thing is, having been on the field at the end of the NCAA championship game for most of the last 6 or 7 years, the idea that there hasn't been a serious injury by virtue of somebody getting hit with a flying helmet.
Sorry for the humble brag there, by the way.
That's not a brag.
Yeah, just down on the field at all the championships. Go on.
I don't understand how this hasn't happened.
It is your job. Yeah, I know what you're saying. Yeah.
Like, people just, these helmets weigh like 3 pounds.
It's absolute bedlam.
Yeah, and they just throw them up in the air.
And it's not like a planned thing, like, hey, I'm going to throw it. It's, you don't even realize you're doing it if you're one of the players. You just do it. It's a involuntary reaction of something, of years of hard work, literally blood, sweat, and tears all coming to fruition at the same time. And you can't control it. I've been fortunate to win never a national championship, but high school state championships and things like that. You don't realize even what you're doing.
But people don't throw their football helmets. Do they?
It's happened. I've seen it.
Yeah, it's happened. I mean, Dwayne Rudd, Browns fans out there will respect that. But like, not in the same way. Not 50 football helmets literally cascading down from the skies as helpless media members and assistant coaches cower in the corner trying to make sure that this asteroid field doesn't descend upon them.
Speaking of the Browns and things cascading down from the sky, remember when Orlando Brown got hit in the eye with the official's flag in a football game?
Do I remember? I was there.
Oh, no way.
Marty Foy and I sitting on
the
opposite end of the field from the dog pound, see what happened. It's obviously a little bit difficult as a spectator in the stadium to know exactly what happened. See, he obviously leaves the field with a trainer. He's got the ice pack on his eye, whatever. I think he actually went back into the locker room to get treatment and then came back out onto the field. And I'm going to have to look this up on YouTube to figure out how clear my memory actually is. But it's not as if he went to the sideline, stood there for a couple plays, let his anger continue to build and boil, and then went out on the field. I think it was like a WWE coming out of the tunnel, literally going straight into the ring type of situation. And he pushed over, I believe it was Triplett, Jeff Triplett was the referee. Jerry Triplett was the ref involved. And, oh man, it was something because I was in high school. It
flagged
wasn't.
And suspended and fined by the NFL for hitting an official.
Well, and
the
then.
Had blinded him.
Yeah. And then he ended up dying because of complications of the flag issue in his eyes. Yeah. Well, I mean, also, I would imagine that being 400 pounds didn't have.
Yeah, I think he had diabetes or something. Yeah.
But, I mean, I also think he got hit in the eye with a flag and had tremendous circulatory issues as a result.
It didn't end his career, though.
No, he came back.
He played for the Ravens.
Right? Yeah, absolutely. Zeus. Well, now he's like.
Zeus.
Yeah.
I was going to call him Zeus. Zeus. Yeah. Zeus Brown. Oh, man, what a story. Back to
Bedlam
on the
asses in the seats, bud.
I know. Back to Bedlam on the Coast. I know what you're talking about, Terry. But I love watching that. It's always fun. And, to see the passion and excitement on these young men's. And then sometimes to see their stunned coaches. And again, going back to your conversation with Joe Amplo and how he's just, it sometimes doesn't even sink in till later what he just accomplished. That's really cool. Second webcast observation, broadcast option of the week. And it ties into what we're about to talk to next is the selection show. I love Quint's blog of the behind the scenes action at the ESPNU studios in Charlotte that he does. Does he do this every year? It's not the first time I've read this.
Right, yeah, it's not an every year thing, but he definitely did it last year as well.
I love reading stuff like that about how things come together and the schedule and things like that. And it's nice of him to share that. So, Terry, let's get right into the selections then. So the show aired at 9 o'clock on Sunday. And do you want to give people a little bit about how our day goes, a little behind the scenes here at Inside Lacrosse?
Sure. So there are three games, obviously three Division I men's games on Sunday. And we obviously have to track the results of those. And one of them being a Ivy League championship game has significant ramifications on the NCAA tournament field. Fortunately, Duke and Notre Dame won only insofar as it's fortunate that it didn't totally mess up the projections.
Sure.
And then after those results are in, it's my responsibility to do one more version of bracketology. And then it kind of is like, all right, well, it's like 4 o'clock. We can kind of get our eyes off of a computer or a television screen for the first time since Thursday afternoon and, you know, fuel up, take a nap, do whatever you need to do, be ready to go for 9 p.m. once the bracket gets announced. And then, you know, there are some preparations. So obviously we have, because we have these projections, we have at least some baseline expectation for what's going to happen. So we can, you know, start to prepare, pull photos and make sure that people know what their responsibilities are. You've got the snubs and surprises post. You're going to call this guy. I'm going to call this guy, et cetera. So, you know, send out a few text messages. Hey, can I talk to you after the after the bracket's announced, et cetera. And then, you know, once 9 p.m. hits, first it starts with social media, and then it goes to building out the web post and the subsequent web post, which includes obviously talking to some folks. So, you know, there are guys that we talk to regularly. There are guys that we talk to once or twice a year, and it happens to be right around when bracket season hits. So, it's a late night. We went until probably about 1 or 2 a.m. In terms of preparing for Monday morning as well, because we knew that we were going to get another rush of folks that weren't paying attention on Sunday evening coming to the site on Monday morning. We wanted to make sure that everything was in order for them. And then, you hit the sack so that you can rise and grind the next day, making sure that, you know, despite the fact that so much of the season builds towards Selection Sunday, it's kind of the precursor to the pinnacle part of the season.
I want to commend you on your last bracketology that you did on Sunday. You were pretty spot on for the most part. You had a couple of teams reversed.
It's difficult. And obviously, as we talk about the bracket selection, if you want to know what my opinion is, then look at how surprised I am. Just look at what my projection was and compare it to what ended up happening. Right. So I think that in our last projection, we had Harvard in over Navy. We had Air Force in the play-in game over Towson. And we had Loyola on the road and Duke hosting. So those were kind of the three switches. Wow. Yeah. There were a few, you know, so there were a few hot-button points that people got upset about from the bracket in terms of the committee's performance. I think the biggest one was Rutgers getting left out while Johns Hopkins was included. I think that is, it's funny. The common sense approach would say that if you beat a team twice, you should be in the tournament and they shouldn't be. But for the sake of the selection criteria.
Given all the other factors. Like, right. You sort of have fairly even resumes.
Well, I mean, I think that when you start,
there could be occasion where a team beats somebody twice,
and they're 2-10. And, yeah. No, I hear you, but Rutgers was 11-4. They had a better record than Hopkins. They just didn't have the quality wins, and the other metrics in terms of the RPI and the strength of schedule were not that high. A couple of points of clarification there. Saw some comments on them, both on our site as well as on social media, to the effect of preseason perception has something to do with both of those factors. That is incorrect. Both strength of schedule and RPI are based solely on teams' win percentages.
Sure.
So just point of clarification for anybody who's under a misapprehension. And I think that the area in which Rutgers' criteria fell far short was they just didn't have an additional quality win beyond Johns Hopkins. I think that there were a couple of opportunities to get them, and they didn't take advantage of them. And obviously, I would imagine that despite the disappointment in Piscataway around, you know, whether it be the staff or the players, they're competitors, and they understand that they had an opportunity to make it to the NCAA tournament by virtue of beating Maryland on Saturday afternoon. They didn't do it. They left it in somebody else's hands. And unfortunately, this is sometimes the result of that scenario.
So let's just go through the bracket really quickly, at least the seeding. Maryland got the top overall seed.
As projected. And yeah. So as a result, obviously, I have no surprise.
Number one seed there. Number two seed, Denver. Their loss to the Big East Championship game didn't seem to affect them. We thought they'd be in the 2-3 range anyway. That's where they held up. Notre Dame's the number three seed. Yale got the four seed over Brown by virtue of winning the Ivy League Championship. Brown falling. Brown's the number five seed. Number six seed was a bit of a surprise. Lots of talk about this one. We'll get into it. Marquette is the number six seed. Maybe went from being on the bubble somewhere to a good run through the Big East Championship and garners the number six seed. Loyola is the number seven seed. and Syracuse at number 8. So the ACC champ gets the 8th seed. Terry, in terms of seeding, again, there's lots of ways to approach this, so let's sort of talk about the seeding. You know, they don't really seed the teams 9 through 18 that make it, or excuse me, 9 through 20.
No, you're right, 9 through 18.
But there is sort of a seeding to it.
They try to be as faithful to bracket integrity as they can be while accounting for necessary travel issues.
Sure. So, Terry, can you walk us through what the NCAA stated criteria is, and then we'll sort of look at how it may have shaken out?
And I sure can, Dan.
And then we'll look at some of the snubs and then some of the surprises, and then we'll talk about first-round games and make some predictions.
You're ready to make a prediction?
Yeah.
So as it relates to what the criteria are, it starts with, I'll just read it, strength of schedule index, results of the RPI, record against ranked teams 1 through 5, 6 through 10, 11 through 15, 16 through 20, 21 plus. That is all sorted by RPI. Average RPI win, meaning the average RPI of all your wins. I don't understand why they felt the need that they had to clarify that. Average RPI loss, head-to-head competitions, results for versus common opponents, significant wins and losses, location of contests, input from the regional advisory committees. So my mantra, my tagline, what I've said many times about this, the criteria is objectively subjective because everything that I just listed is a piece of objective data. With the exception of the input from the regional advisory committee, these are all facts. That being said, they don't have a rubric by which they are meant to be applied. So as a result, committee to committee can choose how to utilize this criteria to fill out the bracket, which means that you could theoretically state they can choose the bracket that they want and work in reverse, figuring out a way in which, I don't think they do that, but ultimately the biggest downfall of this system is that it's so reliant on one individual's ability to explain the decisions that that individual's ability to do it, to explain the decisions that were made in the room, has more to do with how the bracket is perceived than the actual bracket itself. And so this isn't the only sport or the only committee for the NCAA for which that's true. Obviously, Jeff Long made weekly appearances on ESPN when he was talking about how the College Football Playoff Committee was putting together its rankings throughout the season. But the difference is that that was a purely subjective opinion. Now, obviously, they utilized objective data, but they didn't necessarily have this list of criteria that they were meant to digest and then spit out what their interpretation of that criteria was. This committee, when it comes time to having to explain it, you're talking about millions of pieces of data that they probably collectively, six or seven people. I mean, there are five committee members and they have advisors that work for the NCAA that are in the room with them as well. That list that I just read probably contains at least 1,000 to 25,000 pieces of data per team. And then you're probably considering 20 teams, 25 teams. So just the amount of information that is digested over the course of certainly the last weekend, but the preceding 3 to 6 weeks ahead of that is so vast that to expect any person to be able to explain it clearly is a Herculean task.
Well, because so many of these teams play each other and one outcome affects the next outcome, it is very difficult, to your point. The other thing is how they weigh each of the criteria as it goes down the list and factor that into team A's versus team B, team C, to line up the field. It doesn't always weigh exactly the same either. So, you know, it could be, well, strength of schedule is why this team got in. and this team got in because of a head-to-head win. So it's not all equal footing. So it is a complicated task.
Well, what you're talking about is applying the criteria consistently, or at least that's the way I understand it.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily – I think what you're trying to say is that it isn't always applied consistently, but it's okay not. Because the decisions are parsed out individually. And I think that that's one of the things – that's the way that I do my bracket projections. I try to put all of the team – so, you know, we do a boiled-down resume. On the third page – or on the last page of every bracketology post, you're going to see number one Maryland, 10-5, you know, whatever the – it's going to say team name, record. It's going to list their top five wins. It's going to list their wins 6 through 20. It's going to say who their games remaining are against, and then it's going to list their RPI. That is only about probably 20% of the criteria that I read off when I listed the official NCAA criteria. But the reason that we choose that is because that's, in my opinion, the boiled-down version, the most important data to be put in one place at one time so that people can understand it clearly and concisely. And then what I do is put every team against each other, and then so it's like, all right, this looks like the best, so who's second? And then there are like two or three candidates that are, you know, have roughly the same RPI, roughly the same number of quality wins. You look at them side by side and you say, this is second, and you do that all the way down the list. And then, like, once I'm done, then I go back and I do it again, and I'm just like, does this logically follow? Is this resume better than this resume better than this resume? And so how I imagine this conversation going when they get to the end of this process as a selection committee is they're only choosing one team versus the other. And so the hinge point in that decision oftentimes is going to be different than the hinge point in... So when you're trying to decide between 6 and 7, the thing that separates those two resumes most substantially might be the worst loss. Their RPIs might be very similar. Their quality win factor might be pretty similar, whatever. But like one team's worst loss might be to a team with an RPI of 21. The other one might be an RPI rank 45. And you're just going to say, that's it. That's the reason that we're going with team A at number 6 and team B at number 7. But then when you get to number 14 versus number 15, which is the bubble, we're going to go with team A over team B, not because they, you know, both teams' worst losses were to the same team, number 22. But team A's RPI is 11 and team B's RPI is 19, and that's the biggest determining factor in their resumes. So we're going with team A. Is that is that an inconsistent application of the criteria? Maybe that's why the criteria is not listed in terms of how it's supposed to be implemented.
A lot to unpack right there. So
get at my level.
Let's take it this way. That was Terry venting.
I don't even know who I'm venting against, because I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, it's a tough job that the committee has to do, so I have sympathy for them. But also, a lot of the people that complain about the job the committee did don't understand how they're supposed to try to do it.
Yeah. So I don't think anyone has a problem with Maryland being number one. I think Denver number two, Notre Dame number three is fine. The first place we saw some people questioning was the Yale-Brown. But
because Yale was over Brown, despite the fact that Brown had a head-to-head win? Because I heard people griping about the fact that Yale and Brown were 4-5 at all. And I was just like, no, that's exactly where both of them belong.
I agree with that. But Yale beat the number one team in the whole field, and that's the best quality win you can get, and won the championship and wasn't coming off a loss, so I'm fine with that. Brown number five, they're kind of be interchangeable anyway. They'll probably have to play each other, whether the four side or the five seed. It doesn't really matter. You'd be playing each other anyway if you advance through the first round. So we're good through 1 through 5. 6 is where I think people started to take notice. Like, well, Marquette, number 6. I mean, just from people texting me, like, I can't believe that. How's that possible? Their RPI was number 6.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if that's one of the major factors, their strength of schedule, having Denver on there twice, obviously helps them. And through the conference, they played Denver the last week of the season, lost 13-9 or something like that. Then came back and beat Villanova and beat Denver.
Villanova, whose RPI finished up at 15.
And their RPI skyrocketed. So there are some question marks, but you can kind of see why the committee would have put them there. But they did go from, in some people's mind, if they lose to Villanova, we talked about that, it's like a play-in game for the bubble. If they lose to Villanova, they don't make the tournament. And now they're hosting a game as the number 6 seed. So I think that's where some people, in a lot of people's minds, started.
Yeah, so I think that Marquette should have been the 7th seed. I think Duke should have been the 6th seed. I think the biggest source of consternation was a team that lost to Duke 16-1 3 weeks ago is seeded and another one is not.
Yes.
And I agree with that. I think I had Duke projected as a 6 seed.
How would the committee have overlooked that? Like, again, 3 weeks ago, Marquette went down to Duke and Duke pasted them 16-1. Do you have an explanation for it? Did you ask?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know.
Did you get an answer?
No, not a satisfactory answer about what Marquette did to make them a 6 seed versus what Duke. You know, I think that Duke should have been the 6 seed and Marquette should have been the 7 seed. So as a result, I wasn't upset about Marquette being a 6 seed because that deviation isn't super substantial. I did ask, was there a flaw in Duke's resume? And was there a reason that they fell to an unseeded team? And it almost was.
Duke had a bad weekend. In the beginning of March, they lost to Harvard on March 5th and to Richmond on March 7th.
Yeah, that was a Monday night.
Yeah, and then those are the only blips. They lost to Air Force, a tournament team. They lost to North Carolina, a tournament team. Notre Dame and Syracuse and Denver early in the season in a close game.
So
some pretty good teams.
When I asked,
in terms of strength of schedule, it helps.
When I asked committee chair Gene Doris, was there a flaw in Duke's resume that prevented them from hosting a game? He said, when it came down to it, it's like you had a lot of schizophrenic resumes from teams that you don't usually see that from. Duke and Carolina, they had great wins and some peculiar losses. So to me, that suggests, you know, you just had a problem with the bad losses on Duke's resume. You know, if that's the case, margin of victory I didn't say margin of victory when I was reading the criteria. So the fact that Marquette lost to Duke by 15 in Durham.
Same as an overtime win.
Or overtime loss in Marquette's case.
So, but Duke's good wins, you know, they beat Loyola on the road. They beat Syracuse. They beat Marquette. And they beat Notre Dame on the road. So they had some, well, in the ACC tournament. So they had some good wins. Moving on. Loyola gets the number 7 seed. You didn't have them.
I had them on the road, and I actually had them going to Marquette. So, you know, in my mind, they were 10th because I was trying to be, you know, as pure to the bracket as possible. That was actually, something that the previous iterations of the committee cared about. So I saw them as sitting there at number 10. So, you know, it was a 3-spot jump. And the comment that Mr. Doris made to me was they were playing better down the stretch and they won the Patriot League tournament. You know, it's a little bit perturbing to me only insofar as...
Neither of those are criteria.
Yep. But at the same time, you know, I do think that Loyola is right there about the number 7th best team in the country. You know, my question is it the committee's job, and this is part of the identity crisis that makes this exercise so difficult, is it the committee's job to pick the best teams, or is it their job to pick the most deserving teams?
Sophie's choice right there, Terry. It's tough. Tough to say. And then the number 8 seed was Syracuse, and Cuse fans were not happy with that. And I don't think Maryland fans were happy with that either. The winner, if Maryland gets 5, Hartford, Quinnipiac, in a playing game, they got to play the winner of Syracuse and Albany in a quarterfinal game. That's tough for a 1 seed.
Well, if any fan who watched the Maryland-Syracuse quarterfinal in 2011 remembers that game, or was it a quarterfinal game or a first-round game? No, it was a quarterfinal game. That was the one that featured, I believe, 10 stall warnings from the Terps. They're not going to be happy about that if that's an effort that gets duplicated either. I don't think that it will be. I'm not overly concerned about that. But, so Syracuse hosting Albany. I mean, I went the other way. I projected that Albany was going to be hosting Syracuse. So, you know, that was a function of the fact that obviously Syracuse had a great ACC tournament and climbed the charts a little bit. But, you know, I think Albany would have been a top 5 seed had they not lost to Stony Brook. It was difficult for me to see them slip all the way to 9 by virtue of that loss. I'm sorry, I said Stony Brook, but I meant Hartford. That being said, obviously they did, and you know, I'm not gonna quibble over one spot.
I don't want to gloat, Terry, but a few weeks ago, when Albany was the number 5 team in the country, and I was a little shocked by that, and then it moved up to number 4. I said I think they're more like the number 9 team. I don't think they deserve a first round game, so I feel a little bit
vindicated,
yes, about their seeding, right about where I think that they belong, and. That's going to be a good match. So let's get into the games, Terry. There's 2 playing games tomorrow. Another place where maybe someone got slighted a little bit was the Towson Tigers are going to host Hobart tomorrow in a play-in game. Hartford and Quinnipiac will play the other one. The winner of that game, Hartford-Quinnipiac, will play Maryland on Sunday at 12:30. But over here, on the other half of the bracket, the Towson-Hobart winner gets Denver on the road.
So, obviously, the state's going to come down to Baltimore. Towson is a team with a tremendous defensive prowess. They're a top three defense in the country, have been all year long. You know, I believe Lowe, Cordes, Conroy. They're stacked with poles, and then they're playing in front of Tyler White, who I've said on this podcast a couple times, I think is one of the best pure stoppers in college lacrosse. Hobart's a team that's been very reliant on Frankie Brown, a guy that we've been familiar with since his time on the recruiting trail. Chris Islanian is a freshman who has come on really strong. He has 35 points in 16 games so far this season. But a very balanced effort. Shout out to Cooper Stefaniak, a senior midfielder who has 19 points on the season and was pretty vocal about Inside Lacrosse's odds projection of Hobart's ability to win the NEC tournament.
It's just math, man. It's just math.
To me, Hobart is a very balanced team. And obviously, you know, you look up and down their schedule, 8-7 win over Canisius, 7-6 loss to Colgate, season opening 17-12 loss to Penn State that was closer earlier in that game before the Nittany Lions kind of exploded. And then, you know, like we mentioned, the 15-2 loss versus Bryant. They're a team that can play a bunch of different games, and I really don't have a read on how this Towson matchup is going to shake out. I think that most people are, you know, you see Las Vegas Lions. I think he pegged the Tigers at three goal favorites. It seems right about in line with what the expectations are. On the other end, in the other playing game, I think Quinnipiac and Hartford both come in with incredibly strong faceoff performances. By McEwen's faceoff ratings, Dylan Protesto is probably at least a dozen spots better than Will Vitelli. So that's an area for advantage from Hartford. But I do think they're relatively evenly matched teams, and I think it's going to be a great game. That one is at 4 p.m., and it'll be streamed on ESPN3, so that's pretty exciting. And I think that both those teams are going to have tall orders. I think when it comes to the playing game selection and the fact that Towson's playing in it and not Air Force, I was under the impression that the four lowest RPI AQ teams were immediately slotted into the playing game. It turns out that that is how it has worked out in 2014 and 2015. It turns out that those teams can be selected through the same criteria that every selection is made in the NCAA tournament field, and that's where the separating factor between Towson and Air Force's resume was the Tigers' loss to Delaware being a bad loss, and that's what destines them for the playing game and then having to quickly turn around and play at Denver on Sunday as opposed to what likely would have been their fate, a trip to Notre Dame and a rematch from a 2015 first-round matchup that was really competitive. And then on the flip side, obviously Maryland's going to be ready for the winner of Quinnipiac versus Hartford, and I think turning around to play the Terps on short rest is a difficult task. So,
who do you like in those games? Who do you pick playing games?
I'm going to pick Towson, and I'm going to pick Hartford.
Yeah, those are my picks too. Very interesting fact in the Towson-Hobart game. Not only are both those guys Hopkins grads, Hopkins defensemen, but they each worked for Bill Tierney, Denver coach.
So that's right.
They're going to get to go play their one of the mentors. Does the winner of the Towson-Hobart game, does that coach become the next coach in Princeton too? Is that what the victor
like
in that game
the gets? Victor leaves town?
Yeah. Is that what they?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. If Hobart wins, I do not think Greg Raymond is a shoo-in to become the Princeton head coach. If Towson wins, well, first of all, this is assuming that either of these guys wants the job.
True.
If Towson wins, I think it reinforces what would be a pretty common perception that Sean Nanolin would be the best get for Princeton. Yeah. I don't know.
Okay. Let's stay in Denver, Terry. As we work our way through this bracket, Sunday, 3 o'clock, again, all of the first round games are on ESPNU. This will be the Towson Hobart winner playing number two Denver on Sunday at 3 o'clock. It's Eastern time.
We have both picked Denver. I'm sorry, we have both picked Towson to play Denver. Yes. So now, do you see the Pios losing streak extending to two?
No, I see them. Really, their game plans will be very different based on who they play. But I see them getting by either of the teams that advance from the playing game. And I have Denver moving on.
I do as well. I actually, this is not the type of thing that you typically hear in this type of media forum. I'm not looking forward to this game. It doesn't really matter who wins, because if it's Towson versus Denver, like, they're such grinded out long possession teams. It's going to be like, when Denver has the ball, it's going to be like an arm wrestling match. Just like, keep working it around, keep working it around, keep working it out. Umbrella dodges. Umbrella Norman dodges.
Dale. I want four passes. I want four passes.
I mean, it'll be interesting, but it probably won't be that exciting. Towson just played a 4-2 conference championship game.
I know.
All right, let's move on.
Let's just go right up that the right-hand side of the bracket, Terry. The next game, really the first game of the weekend, it'll be Saturday at noon on ESPNU. Number 7, Loyola versus Duke. It feels right to have a first-round game with these two teams playing.
Couldn't feel any differently about this game than I did about the previous one that we just discussed. I think that both these teams are playing the best they've played all year. Obviously, like, you know, Duke's last 8 minutes or whatever against Syracuse did not go very well. But even being able to go toe-to-toe in the conference championship after beating Notre Dame in the conference semifinals of the ACC tournament, and then I was able to watch a good portion of their game versus Boston University on Sunday, and I was really impressed by how well the complementary pieces, you know, Demar Klass had a great shooting day. I thought Miles Jones had a good day, but he wasn't super productive, and that was because there were enough other guys that were picking up the slack from the point-producing standpoint. And obviously Duke's defense has been playing so much better. I think that it's going to be such an interesting matchup because, you know, Pat Spencer has emerged as maybe the best quarterback behind the goal dodging attackman in all of college lacrosse, and it's crazy to say that. But even Connor Canizero, that's not necessarily how I would describe him. When he dodges, he's more of an ass dodger from the wing. He's more of a right-handed player. Obviously, he's a dual threat in terms of his feeding and scoring ability. But, like, I don't know. There's something about Pat. There's something about Spencer that feels more pure. And as a result, I'm really interested in seeing how. And by that, I don't mean pure in terms of his playing style. I mean pure in terms of his role. He reminds me of that Connor Gill style type of player. There's something about the way that Duke's going to defend that I'm really curious to see because, again, despite the fact that Duke's defense has been playing so much better over the last 4 or 5 weeks, this isn't necessarily the type of offensive player they've seen. I mean, Matt Cavanaugh is certainly a dangerous dodger, but, again, he's kind of the opposite of Canizero, where he's going to work on that lefty wing and dodge from the wing, even though he's dangerous from behind and he can certainly get to his left hand coming from below GLE, and whether it's go topside or roll back, you know, all of those things are much different in the way that you have to prepare versus the way that Duke's going to have to prepare for Pat Spencer. And particularly given the fact that he's developed such good offensive chemistry with Zach Harawires in those back passes and Harawires' ability to catch around, you know, he catches passes everywhere, but particularly I love the way he catches passes over his shoulder, around his head, he's able to get the ball on cage. I just think that Loyola's offense is primed. And I think that this is going to be a you know, maybe not like a 30-goal game in the way that I expect Brown versus Hopkins to be, but probably a, you know, one of those classic 12-11 games, and I'm going to pick Loyola.
Terry, this is a rematch of a game on March 12th that was also at Loyola. Duke won that one 15-6, and Miles Jones had 5 goals and 3 assists. He was tough to shut down. What will they do to slow him down?
Well, I think that you got – I mean, Loyola is a very traditional defensive team. You know, they rarely double pull. They put their opposing long stick – they put their long stick on the opposing midfield – the opposing team's best midfielder. You know, they try not to slide too much. So I just think you're going to see a lot of Ryan Fournier with, you know, just trying to win the matchup. I think that, you know, it's going to put Miles in a position to try to be a scorer, less a feeder. If he's shooting well that day, it's going to be a dangerous thing for the Greyhounds. They got to do a good job against Duke's early offense. and they got to figure out ways to dominate possession. They got to figure out ways to play fast without Duke getting extra offensive possessions. Loyola needs to be really good in the clearing game.
I'm with you on this one. I'm going to pick the Greyhounds, and they will advance to play, according to my bracket, Denver.
Even though the seeded team at home, it feels like we're picking an upset.
A little bit. Yeah, like this was a game that, it was a tough one to pick, and I kind of went back and forth, but I'm going to take Loyola at home. They'll have an awesome crowd there, and I'm gonna pick the Grams. Terry, moving up the bracket, number six Marquette, surprise to a lot of people, will host a traditional power North Carolina in a playoff game at Saturday at 2:30. What's your take on this match?
Well, another one that I'm really excited for, primarily because of the novelty of it.
Yeah, it's going to be cool to watch.
Contrasting styles, be a great basketball game.
a lot of light blue.
Yeah, the idea of a home playoff game in Milwaukee is really cool.
I think the snow's melted yet.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't mean it's not going to snow on Saturday morning. I'm picking Marquette. I think it's going to be a great game. I think that they're going to be able to, you know, pull out a 12-10 victory.
I'm going to take the Tar Heels, I think.
Finally, some divergence.
Yeah, I'm going to go against the chalk in this one. Like the Tar Heels, feel like they're a little disrespected, but they are playing better. I'm going to take the Kellys in this one. Terry, Notre Dame Air Force. Used to be, one team from the
GWLL.
West. Yeah, used to get in. And now these two teams are meeting in the first round of the tournament. This game will be on Saturday at 7:30, sort of the nightcap of ESPNU's coverage. I like Notre Dame in this one. I just think they have too much. I think that they are hungry and angry. Hangry, as the kids call it. And I think they're going to take care of business.
I think that this is going to be a little bit reminiscent of that Detroit matchup from, I believe, 2013. When the Titans put a scare into Notre Dame. And I don't mean that in the sense that, like, obviously Detroit was known for its high-pressure defense. They were able to take the ball away a lot, had Notre Dame on their heels. I just think that Air Force is going to come out with a lot of vim and vigor, and I think that they're going to be able to compete effectively throughout this game. I think it will be very difficult for Notre Dame to run away and hide at any point, and I think that, you know, even if they build a three-goal lead, Air Force is going to find an answer, and it's one of those games that's going to be nip and tuck the whole way. I'm going to pick Notre Dame because they are so good in end-of-game situations. Got in an argument about this on Twitter with somebody over the last 2 weeks when my point was, yeah, I understand that they've been living on a high wire over the course of the season, but they've won so many of these games that at some point you have to disregard it as being good fortune and regard it as being skill. I'm at that point with the Fighting Irish, and I think that in a very similar way to the fact that I said Air Force's inherent quality emerged late versus Richmond, I think that's exactly what's going to happen in this one, where Notre Dame, you know, I don't know who it's going to be. Can imagine John Sexton, you know, picking some Air Force midfielder's pocket in a one-goal game, picking up a ground ball, going end-to-end, hitting the point on fast break, and that's the two-goal go-ahead that decides the outcome. But I do think that Notre Dame's going to make that play down the stretch to differentiate themselves from the pack and pull out the victory.
Well, we both agree that Notre Dame's going to win this. I think Air Force had a great season, have a really nice team, but I don't think this is going to be that close. I got a question for you. I know what vigor is, but I'm not exactly sure what vim is.
Are we sure that it actually is a word and not just part of an expression?
It just sounds nice. Yeah. The alliteration there. Okay. Terry, let's get to the top of the other side of the bracket, the Maryland side of the bracket. They will play the winner of Hartford and Quinnipiac. I think we both picked Hartford in that one. This will be the first game on Sunday at 12:30. I'm taking the Terps.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I just feel like, to your point, that they're playing better than anybody else right now. Clearly, that's the case. And I also feel like, you know, we talked about the idea, and I'm not sure whether we talked about this in the podcast or offline, you know, the way that normal people do. Maryland can score from so many different places that you don't have to worry about everybody going cold on one day. They just have too many guys. They have 9 guys that can score. They don't have, you know, 2 or 3 guys that can put up more than a couple points in a game. So that's where you worry about their ability to be so explosive that they blow good teams out.
They seem to be sort of egoless as well. You know, if you look at the all-Big Ten team, there were, I think Burnlor was the only first-teamer. That's not to say that they're not good or they don't have first-team talent. It's just that their stats are so balanced. And to your point, on any given day, someone's going to score 2, 3, 4 goals. But it's not like a, you know, Duke's going to ride Miles Jones and Demer Class. Like, they need those guys to play well in NCAA tournament type of games. Maryland's got so many different guys that can score. And they'll share the ball, and they don't care who does it as long as they win.
Dan, we've got breaking news.
What's that, Tim?
Vim is defined as energy and enthusiasm.
Well, you have plenty of that, Terry. And vigor. Actually, I think this should now be called the Vim and Vigor Podcast.
Are you Vim or are you
Vigor? I think I'm Vim. I think I'm Vim. Well, you have plenty of it. And you're definitely Vigor.
Ebullient was also a word on that list.
I dropped that earlier today. And rest. McNair was very, I used the word rest control or something like that.
Yeah, rest with a W.
Yeah.
The silent W.
Now, Terry, moving on to the next game. Syracuse-Albany, a rematch, upstate. Fans are going to be packed in the dome. This is Sunday night, 7:30. I haven't picked this game yet. I don't know who's going to win this. I want to hear your breakdown and analysis. And then
so you want to steal my pick?
No, I'm going to listen to what you say, and then I'll pick whether it's the team I'll make my own choice. I'm my own man, Terry.
Yeah,
my Vim will come through.
Okay, so there's a lot about Syracuse that feels similar to Maryland in the sense that they have a lot of offensive options. I think that the biggest difference is that Dylan Donahue represents an emotional core that you don't identify with Maryland offensively, right? I think that a lot of who they are from an experience standpoint, a lot of who they are from an emotional center standpoint comes from the defensive end. And so to a degree, that's almost a strength in the way that you can utilize that in transition, right? So like Isaiah Davis Allen is the guy that you expect to lift Maryland, whether it's a big play when they're trailing or, you know, that type of scoring the third goal in succession that gets the bench going crazy and the other team's just like, I don't know how we're going to come back and win this game. I think Dylan Donahue is that guy for Syracuse, but I think that he's a little bit more reserved. So I think that ultimately, like, Syracuse doesn't necessarily have that same type of vim and vigor that can, you know, kind of get the opposing team on its heels. And what's interesting about that is that it's so contrary to Albany. They're a team that over the course of the season has really struggled putting teams away. They're so good at staying on the front foot, but only when they're on the front foot. They're also so good at taking their foot off the gas. I saw this in person when they took on UMBC, and I thought that I was impressed by their ability to get back in the game once UMBC came back and tied at 14-14 and score and win in overtime. There's something about that that seems strong to me. But on the flip side, what I'm laying out is the case for why I think this isn't going to be another close game. You know, I think that whereas, you know, the Loyola-Duke game is shaping up as a 12-11 type affair, to me this one has more of a 13-12, 14-13 quality to it. I think that Evan Malloy's emergence for Syracuse has helped because there's no uncertainty in the goal now. You know who's going to start and you know who's going to finish the game. But I don't think that he'll win a goalie battle against Blaze Reardon. And as a result, I'm going to do it. I'm going to pick Albany because I feel like I can imagine Blaze Reardon making that Gunnar Walt kick save that sent Brian to the quarterfinals 2 years ago. And it's enough for me to say that I think Albany's going to go back to the quarterfinals for the third year in a row.
I'm gonna go with the Cuse. I think they're one of the best teams. I mean, they got to play Maryland, but they have a good shot of, if they can get by Albany, they could be a team that could beat Maryland. I think Cuse is playing well, coming off the ACC championship. And your talk about Dylan Donahue and the way that they play is what persuaded me to take the Cuse.
You know what's been interesting about this? Faceoffs don't feel that important to this first round. Like, Ben Williams might win 20 of 25 faceoffs. Albany can't get the ball. And as a result, Syracuse is just going to steamroll them. There are a couple of games for which that could happen. I mean, obviously, Trevor Baptiste possesses that capability. You know, if Hartford wins and Dylan Protesto wins 18 of 24 faceoffs against Austin Henningsen and Will Bonaparte, like, we just haven't talked about faceoffs. And I don't know what that means. Because if we were doing this podcast last year, we absolutely would have talked about faceoffs. It feels like there are enough good teams, and the good teams have a good enough faceoff guy, that despite the fact that faceoffs were clearly an outcome in some of the upsets, or clearly a factor in the outcome of some of the upsets last week, it just doesn't feel like they're misrepresenting the outcome of the game. I don't know if you feel that way.
No, I totally agree. It's basically the first time we've talked about it this whole podcast, about faceoffs being a factor. And thinking about it in a sort of big view, without, I don't know, the specific faceoff guy for every team like you do. Yeah, the fans' view, I would agree with you that that's it could be in one particular game, but as a whole, it doesn't seem like it's an overwhelming factor in a team's success this year.
Well, then let's go to New England, where it could have a pretty substantial impact in both of the games.
Will Correll.
Yes. And so he would be the guy that I would say has both come on the scene so dramatically, and obviously when Batiste and Williams were known quantities heading into the year, you know, they don't necessarily have the same level of novelty.
Was not available for one of Brown's losses.
Also a significant factor. And the best by win percentage so far this season, obviously. The biggest thing here is that Johns Hopkins is a more middle-of-the-road face-off team. They are a defensive team that, in my opinion, should be able to match up to Brown a little bit because Nick Fields is their number one cover guy. And, you know, he's tall but powerful. He feels like if he's not a good matchup for Dylan Molloy, he's a better matchup than most teams can offer. So if that's what it takes to be able to, quote-unquote, slow Brown down in the six-on-six, then that's a good starting point. And then on the other end of the field, if being smart is what it takes to slow down Brown in transition, then all of a sudden, you know, Hopkins is a very smart team offensively. Maybe that's the recipe for them to compete. But as it is, you know, I think this is a game that goes to 30 in terms of total goals.
Why do you feel that way? I've heard, you're not the first person I've heard say this.
Because
I feel like Hopkins is going to have trouble scoring. They're going to have continued problems scoring out of the midfield. I mean, Ryan Brown might have 5 goals and Shaq 6 assists or something like that, but I just don't see them getting to 15 goals.
I think that they're going to be able to back cut and step down a fair amount against a high-pressure Brown defense. I think Brown is going to say, we have an athletic advantage at that end of the field, so we are going to let Alec Tullett and Larkin Kemp and our guy from California, whose name I'm very intimidated to pronounce, just get out and chase people down. And I think that they will cause some turnovers and get the ball on the ground and get to the field and get some easy goals. I think it'll justify that strategy. But I also think that Hopkins is going to be able to take advantage of it through their ball movement and be able to get in scoring positions.
So who are you picking in this?
Brown.
Yeah, sadly, I think this is the first time I've ever done this. I'm picking against the Blue Jays. I'm going to take Brown at home, and they will advance to next week's quarterfinal at Brown. Which will be interesting. So, Terry, the last game of the weekend on our sheet, it will be Sunday at 5:15, Yale versus Navy, number 4 seed Yale versus the Middies.
Yeah, and this is another one where you could very easily see faceoff playing a factor. Brady Dove will be a faceoff advantage for Navy over at Yale. I'm going to pick the Bulldogs in this one because, first of all, I think Yale is playing very well. Second of all, I already talked about their toughness. Third of all, I think that Navy, while they are so good defensively, they'll be able to clamp down a little bit. I think Yale is going to get a couple of those types of extra effort type goals, you know, whether it be off the ride or a turnover or something to that effect. And ultimately, I don't, even though Yale is injured in their own defensive end, you know, I don't see Navy getting past 7 goals, and I see like a 9 or an 8-7 win for Yale.
Yeah, I'm going to pick Yale, too, in a low-scoring game. Something ugly, 7-6, 7-5, something like that. But I'll take you out. And that rounds out our week, Terry.
What a podcast.
It was a lot. Let's go to new words.
We came up with a title for the podcast.
We did.
We don't need new words to live by. We came up with a title for the podcast.
Yeah.
Those are our words to live by.
Vim and Verve. If you
Nope, that's not even it. Jesus Christ.
Vim and Vigor. You will succeed.
New words to live by. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah. Enjoy the games. Inside Lacrosse Podcast.